The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.
This is episode 5 of Project Hail Mary. Our scientist has been doing a lot of experiments, but in this episode, he may find that he's not alone and things change a great deal. There are so many experiments I'll need to do, I don't even know where to begin. I should see where the line leads, for starters, one of the planets, obviously, but which one and what's interesting about it? And I should get a sample of local astrophage to see if it's the same as what we have back on Earth. I could do that by flying into the Petrova line itself and then scraping the dust off the hull with an EVA. I could spend a week just writing up a list of experiments I want to do. I spot a flash on the screen, just a quick bip of light. What's that? I say. Another clue? The flash happens again. I pan and zoom in on that portion of space. It's nowhere near the Petrova line or Tau Ceti. Maybe a reflection from a planet or asteroid? I can see how that might happen. A highly reflective asteroid could be bouncing enough light from Tau Ceti around that I see it on the Petrovascope, but it's intermittent, so maybe it's an irregular shape that's rotating and the flash becomes a solid light source. It's just on now, nonstop. I peer at the screen. What's going on here? The light source becomes brighter. Not instantly, just gradually over time. I watch for a minute. It seems to get brighter faster now. Is it an object headed toward me? An instant hypothesis pops into my mind. Maybe astrophage are somehow attracted to other astrophage. Maybe some subset of them saw the flare from my engines, which would be the wavelength they use, and they headed toward me. Maybe this is how they find the main migration group. So this could be a clump of astrophage heading my way, thinking I can lead them to the planet with the carbon dioxide? Interesting theory. Nothing to back it up, though. The steady light grows brighter, 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 and then finally disappears. Huh, I say. I wait a few minutes, but the light does not return. I make a mental note of the anomaly. But for now, there's nothing I can do about it. Whatever it was, it's gone now. Back to the Petrova line. The first thing I want to do is find out which planet the line leads to. I guess I'll have to work out how to navigate the ship, but that's another challenge. I pan back to look at the Petrova line. Something's wrong. Half of it is just gone. It's coming out of Tau Ceti, just like it was a few minutes ago. But then it stops abruptly at a seemingly arbitrary point in space. What is going on? Did I mess up their migration pattern, maybe? If it's that easy, wouldn't we have worked that out when the Hail Mary was wandering around our own solar system? I zoom in on the cutoff point. It's just a straight line, like someone took an X-Acto knife to the whole Petrova line and threw away the scrap. A giant line of migrating astrophage doesn't just disappear. I have a simpler explanation. There's something on the camera lens, some blob of debris, maybe a wad of overexcitable astrophage. That would be nice. I'd have a sample to look at right away. Maybe a visible light view will give me a better idea of what's going on. I press the toggle button, and that's when I see it. There is an object blocking my view of the Petrova line. It's right next to my ship, maybe a few hundred meters away. It's roughly triangle-shaped and it has gable-like protrusions along its hull. Yes, I said hull. It's not an asteroid. The lines are too smooth, too straight. This object was made, fabricated, constructed. Shapes like that don't occur in nature. It's a ship. Another ship. There's another ship in this system with me. Those flashes of light, those were its engines. It's astrophase powered, just like the Hail Mary. But the design, the shape, it's nothing like any spacecraft I've ever seen. The whole thing is made of huge flat surfaces. The worst possible way to make a pressure vessel. No one in their right mind would make a ship that shape. No one on Earth would, anyway. I blink a few times at what I'm seeing. I gulp. This is an alien spacecraft, made by aliens. Aliens intelligent enough to make a spacecraft. Humanity isn't alone in the universe, and I've just met our neighbors. A flood of thoughts hits me all at the same time. We're not alone. This is an alien. That ship is weird. How does the engineering of that work? Do they live here? Is this their star? Am I starting an interplanetary incident by wandering into alien territory? Breathe, I tell myself. Okay, one thing at a time. What if this is another ship from Earth? One I don't remember. Heck, it took me a few days to remember my name. Maybe Earth sent multiple ships with different designs? Like for redundancy or to increase the odds that at least one of them works? Maybe that ship is the Praise Allah or the Blessings of Vishnu or something. I look all around the control room. There are screens and controls for everything, but there's nothing for a radio. The EVA panel has some radio controls, but that's obviously just for talking to crewmates when they're outside. If they'd sent multiple ships, surely they would have had some radio system so we could talk to each other. Also, that ship, it's insane. I cycle through the navigation console screens until I find the radar panel. I'd noticed it earlier, but I didn't think much of it. I assume it's there so I can get near asteroids or other objects and not collide with them. After a few halting attempts, I manage to turn it on. It immediately spots the other ship and sounds an alarm. The shrill noise hurts my ears. Whoa, 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 I say. I frantically scan the panel until I see a button labeled Mute Proximity Alert. I press it, and the noise stops. I scan the rest of the screen. There's a lot of data here. All in a window titled Blip A. I guess if there were multiple contacts, I'd get multiple windows. Whatever. It's all just raw numbers about the reading. Nothing useful, like an isometric Star Trek scan or anything. Velocity is zero. They have matched my velocity exactly. That can't be a coincidence. Range is 217 meters. I'm assuming that's the distance to the closest part of the other ship. Or maybe the average. No, it would be the closest part. The point of this system is probably to avoid collisions. Speaking of collisions, 217 meters is a ridiculously small distance compared to the size of a solar system. There's no way this is a coincidence. That ship positioned itself here on purpose because I'm here. Another reading, angular width is 35.44 degrees. Okay, some basic math should handle this. I bring up the utility panel on the main screen and launch the calculator app. Something 217 meters away is occupying 35.44 degrees of the view. Presuming the radar can see in all 360 degrees, it would be a pretty cruddy radar if it couldn't. I type some numbers into the calculator to do an arctan operation, and the ship is 139 meters long, roughly. I bring the astrophage panel up on another screen. The little map there shows that the Hail Mary is just 47 meters long. So, yeah, the alien ship is three times the size of mine. There's just no way Earth sent something that big. And the shape. What is up with that shape? I turn my attention back to the Petroviscope, which is now just acting as a camera. The center of the ship is diamond-shaped, a rhombus. Well, I guess it's an octahedron, really. Looks like it has eight faces, each triangular. That part alone is about the size of my ship. The diamond is connected by three thick rods. I don't know what else to call them, to a wide trapezoidal base. That looked like it might be the rear, and in front of the diamond is a narrow stalk, just making up terms at this point. That is four flat panels attached parallel to the main ship axis. Maybe solar panels? The stalk continues forward to a pyramid-shaped nose cone. Nose pyramid, I guess. Every part of the hull is flat. Even the rods have flat faces. Why would anyone do that? Flat panels are a terrible idea. I don't know anything about who made this, but presumably they need some kind of atmosphere inside, right? Huge flat panels are awful at that. Maybe this is just a probe and not an actual ship. Maybe there's no atmosphere inside because there's nothing alive inside. I might be looking at an alien artifact instead of a ship. Still, the most exciting moment in human history. So it's astrophage-powered. That was the steady Petrova frequency glow I saw earlier. Interesting that they have the same propulsion tech as we do. But considering it's the best energy storage medium possible, that's not a surprise. When European mariners first came across Asian mariners, no one was surprised they both used sails. But the why? That's what gets me. Some entity aboard, either a computer or a crew, decided to come to my ship. How did they even know I was here? Same way I saw them, I guess. The massive IR light coming off my engines. And since the rear of my ship was pointed at Tau Ceti, that means I was shining a 540 trillion watt flashlight in their direction. Depending on where they were at the time, I might have appeared even brighter than Tau Ceti itself. At least in the Petrova frequency. So they can see the Petrova frequency, and so can I. I flip through the spin drive console screens until I find one labeled Manual Control. When I select it, a warning dialog pops up. Manual control is recommended only for emergencies. Are you sure you want to enter manual control mode? I tap yes. It brings up another dialog. Second confirmation, type YES to enter manual control mode. I groan and type yes. The panel finally takes me to the manual control screen. It's a bit scary, not because it's complex, but because it's so simple. There are three sliders labeled drive 1, drive 2, and drive 3, each presently at 0. The top of each slider is labeled 10 to the 7th N. The N must mean newtons, a unit of force, I guess. If I threw all three drives into maximum, it would give me about 30 million newtons. That's about 60 times the thrust of jumbo jet engines produced during takeoff. Science fit teachers know a lot of random facts. There are a bunch more little sliders. In groups labeled yaw, pitch, and roll, there must be little spin drives on the sides of the ship to adjust its orientation. I can definitely see why it's a bad idea to mess with this panel. One screw up and I'll put the ship into a spin that tears it apart. But at least they thought of that. There's a button in the middle of the screen labeled Zero All Rotation. Good. I check the petrovoscope again. Blip A hasn't moved. It's on my port side and slightly forward. I flick the petrovoscope back to Petrova frequency mode, and the screen turns mostly black. As before, I can see the Petrova line in the background, occluded by Blip A. Let's see if you have anything to say, I mumble. Spindrive 2 is in the center of the ship. Its thrust will be along my central axis and hopefully won't introduce attitude change. We'll see. I set it to 0.1% power for 1 second, then back to zero. Even with just one engine at 1/1000th power for 1 second, the velocity value for Blip A on the radar panel shows 0.086 m-s. That tiny thrust set my ship moving about 8 centimeters per second. But I don't care about that. I care about the other ship. I watch the petrovoscope. A bead of sweat separates from my forehead and floats away. I feel like my heart is going to beat out of my chest. Then the rear of the ship lights up in the Petrova frequency for 1 second, just like I did. Wow. I flick the drive off and off and on several times. 3 short bursts, a long one, and 1 more short one. There's no message there. I just want to see what they do with it. They were more prepared this time. Within seconds, the other ship repeats the pattern. I gasp and I smile. Then I wince, then I smile again. This is a lot to take in. That was too fast for any probe to respond. If it had remote control or something, the controllers would have to be at least a few light minutes away. There's just nothing around here that could be housing them. There is an intelligent life form aboard that ship. I am about 200 meters away from an honest-to-God alien. I mean, my ship is powered by aliens, but this new one is intelligent. Oh my gosh, this is it. First contact. I'm the guy. I'm the guy who meets aliens for the first time. The Blip A, that's what I'm calling their ship for now, fires up its engines again briefly. I watch closely to memorize a sequence, but it's just a single low-intensity light. They're not signaling. They're maneuvering. I check the radar panel. Sure enough, the Blip A brings itself alongside the Hail Mary and holds position at 217 meters. I flick through the scientific panel to bring the normal telescopic cameras back up. The petrovoscope's normal light camera is just to orient things for the main scope itself. The telescope has much better resolution and clarity. I guess I'm too excited to think clearly because it took me until now to think of it. The image is far clearer through the main telescope. I guess it's just an insanely high-resolution camera, because I can still zoom in and out with no loss of clarity. I have a very good view of the Blip A now. The ship's hull is a mottled gray and tan. The pattern seems random and smooth, like someone started mixing paint but stopped way too early. I spot motion in the corner of the screen. An irregular-shaped object slides along a track in the hull. It's a stalk sticking up with 5 articulated arms coming out of the top. Each arm has a clamp-like hand on the end. It's only now that I notice a network of all the tracks along the hull. It's a robot. Something controlled from the inside. At least I assume it is. It doesn't look like a little green man. And it certainly doesn't look like an alien EVA suit. Not that I have any idea what either of those things would look like. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's a full-mounted robot. Space stations back at Earth have them. They're a nice way to do stuff outside your ship without having to suit up. The robot works its way along the hull until it reaches the spot closest to the Hail Mary. One of its little clamp hands holds a cylindrical object. I don't really have a sense of scale, but the robot is tiny compared to the ship. I feel like it's about my size or maybe smaller, but that's a wild guess. The robot stops, reaches toward my ship, and gently releases the cylinder into space. The cylinder moves slowly toward me. It has a slight rotation end over end. Not perfect, but still a very smooth release. I check the radar panel. The blip A is at velocity zero, and there's a blip B screen now. It shows the much smaller cylinder approaching at 8.6 centimeters per second. Interesting. That's the exact same velocity I moved the Hail Mary a moment ago while flashing the engine to say hi. That can't be a coincidence. They want me to have that cylinder, and they want to deliver it to me at a velocity they know I'm comfortable with. Very considerate of you, I say. These are smart aliens. I have to assume friendly intent at this point. I mean, they're going out of their way to say hi and be accommodating. Besides, if there is hostile intent, what would I do about it? Die. That's what I'd do. I'm a scientist, not Buck Rogers. Well, I mean, I guess I could point the spin drives at their ship, fire them up to full, which would vaporize, you know what? I'm just not going to think along those lines right now. Some quick math tells me the cylinder will take over 40 minutes to reach me. I have that long to get in an EVA suit, go outside, and position myself on the hull for humanity's first touchdown pass reception with an alien quarterback. I learned a lot about the airlock when I was giving my crewmates a burial in space. And Ilya Kuchina would have loved this moment. She would have been absolutely bouncing around the cabin with excitement. Yao would have been stoic and steady, but he would have cracked a smile when he thought we weren't looking. The tears ruined my vision. Lacking gravity, they coat my eyes. It's like trying to see underwater. I wipe them off and fling them across the control room. They splatter onto the opposite wall. I don't have time for this. I have an alien thingy to catch. I unhook the belt on the chair and float over to the airlock. My mind is a whirl with ideas and questions, and I'm jumping to wild, unfounded conclusions left and right. Maybe this intelligent alien species invented astrophage. Maybe they genetically engineered it specifically to grow spaceship fuel, the ultimate in solar power. Maybe once I explain what's happening to Earth, they'll have a solution. Or maybe they'll board my ship and lay eggs in my brain. You can never be sure. I open the inner airlock door and pull out the EVA suit. So, do I have any idea how to get into this thing or how to safely use it? I disable the chrysalis lock of the Orlan MKS-2 EVA suit and open the rear hatch. I activate main power by flicking a switch on the belt. The suit boots up almost immediately, and the status panel attached to the chest component reads, "All systems functional." What the heck? I know everything that's going on in here. We were probably trained on this thing extensively. I know it's the same way I know physics. It's there in my mind, but I don't remember learning it. The Russian-made suit is a single-pressure vessel. Unlike American models, where you put the top and bottom on, then a bunch of complex stuff for the helmet and gloves, the Orlan series is basically a onesie with a hatch in the back. You step into it, close the hatch, and you're done. It's like an insect molting in reverse. I open the back and wriggle into the suit. Zero-G is a real boon here. I don't have to fight with the suit nearly as much as I would normally. Weird. I know this is easier than other times I've done it, but don't remember any other times I've done it. I think I have brain damage from that coma. I'm functional enough for now. I press on. I get my arms and legs into their respective holes. The jumpsuit is uncomfortable. in that Orlan. I'm supposed to be wearing a special undergarment. I even know what it looks like, but it's just for temperature regulation and biomonitoring. I don't have time to find it in the storage area. I have a date with a cylinder. Now in the suit, I push steadily against the airlock wall with my legs to push the open rear flap to the wall. Once it gets to within a few inches, centimeters, I should say, this is a Russian-made, after all. A light turns green on the chest-mounted status panel. I reach up to the panel with my thickly gloved hand and press the auto-seal button. The suit ratchets the opening closed with a series of loud clicks. With a final clunk, the outer seal locks into place. My status board reads green, and I have 7 hours of life support available. Internal pressure is 400 hectopascals, about 40% of Earth's atmosphere at sea level. That's normal for spacesuits. The whole process took only 5 minutes. I'm ready to go outside. Interesting. I didn't have to go through a decompression step. On space stations back home, astronauts have to spend hours in an airlock, slowly acclimating to the low pressure needed for the EVA suit before they can go out. I don't have that problem. Apparently, the entire Hail Mary is at that 40% pressure. Good design. The only reason space stations around Earth have a full atmosphere of pressure is in case the astronauts have to abort and return to Earth in a hurry. But for the Hail Mary crew, where would we go? May as well use the low pressure all the time. Makes things easier on the hull and lets you do rapid EVAs. I take a deep breath and let it out. A soft whirr comes from somewhere behind me, and cool air flows along my back and shoulders. Air conditioning. It feels nice. I grab a handhold and spin myself around. I pull the inner airlock door closed and then rotate the primary lever to begin the cycling sequence. A pump fires up. It's louder than I would have thought. It sounds like an idling motorcycle. I keep my hand on the lever. Pushing it back to the original position will cancel the cycle and repressurize. If I see even a hint of a red light on my suit panel, I'm going to throw that lever so fast it'll make my head spin. After a minute, the pump grows quieter, then quieter still. It's probably as loud as it ever was, but with the air leaving the chamber, there's no way for the noise to get to me other than through my feet touching the Velcro pads on the floor. Finally, the pump stops. I'm in total silence aside from the fans inside the suit. The airlock controls show that the pressure inside is zero and a yellow light turns green. I'm clear to open the outer door. I grab the hatch crank, then hesitate. What am I doing? I say. Is this really a good idea? I want that cylinder so badly. I'm just plowing ahead without any sort of plan. Is this worth risking my life over? Yes. Unequivocally. Okay, but is it worth risking the lives of everyone on Earth over? Because if I mess up and die out there, then the whole Hail Mary project will have been in vain. Yes, it's still worth it. I don't know what these aliens are like, what they want, or what they're planning to say, but they will have information. Any information, even stuff I'd rather not know, is better than none. I spin the handle and open the door. The empty blackness of space lies beyond. The light of Tau Ceti glistens off the door. I peek my head out and see Tau Ceti with my own eyes. At this distance, it's a little less bright than the sun as seen from Earth. I double-check my tether to make darn sure I'm attached. Then I step out into space. I'm good at this. I must have practiced a lot. Maybe in a neutral buoyancy tank or something. But it comes as second nature to me. I exit the airlock and clamp one of my tethers to a rail on the outside hull. Always have two tethers, and always have at least one attached. That way you're never at risk of floating away from the ship. The Orlan MKS-2 is possibly the best EVA suit ever made, but it doesn't have a safer unit like NASA's EMU suit. At least with a safer unit, you have minimal thrust capability to return to the ship if you fall adrift. All that information floods into my mind at once. I guess I've put a lot of time and thought into spacesuits. Maybe I'm our crew's EVA specialist? I don't know. I flip up the sun visor and peer toward the blip A. I wish I could glean some special insight by seeing it in person, but it's pretty far away. The Hail Mary's telescope gave me a much better view. Still, there's something unique about staring directly at an alien spacecraft. I catch a glint of the cylinder every now and then. The flat ends of the gently tumbling cylinder reflect tau light. I've decided tau light is a word, T-A-U-L-I-G-H-T, by the way, light from Tau Ceti. It's not sunlight. Tau Ceti isn't the sun, so tau light. I still have a good 20 minutes before the cylinder reaches the ship. I watch it for a while to guess where it'll hit. It'd be nice to have a crewmate inside at the radar station. It'd be nice to have a crewmate at all. After 5 minutes, I have a good bead on the cylinder. It's headed for roughly the center of the ship. It's as good a place as any for aliens to aim for. I make my way across the hull. The Hail Mary is pretty big. My little pressurized area is only half its length, and the back half flares out to be three times as wide. Most of that will be empty now, I guess. It used to be full of astrophage from our one-way trip here. The hull is crisscrossed with rails and latch points for EVA tethering. Tether by tether, rail by rail, I make my way toward the center of the ship. I have to step over a thick ring. It circles the crew compartment area of the ship. It's a good 2 feet thick. I don't know what it is, but it must be pretty heavy. Mass is everything when it comes to spaceship design, so it must be important. I'll speculate about it later. I continue along one hull latch point at a time until I'm roughly in the center of the hull. The cylinder creeps closer. I adjust my position a tad to keep up with it. After an excruciatingly long wait, it's almost within reach. I wait. No need to get greedy. If I paw at it too early, I might knock it off its course and into space, and I'd have no way of recovering it. I don't want to look dumb in front of the aliens, because they're surely watching me right now, probably counting my limbs, noting my size, figuring out what part they should eat first, whatever. Whatever. I let the cylinder get closer and closer. It's moving less than 1 mile per hour. Not exactly a bullet pass. Now that it's so close, I can estimate its size. It's not big at all, about the size and shape of a coffee can. It's a dull gray color with splotches of slightly darker gray randomly here and there. Similar to the Blip A's hull, kind of. Different color, but same blotchiness. Maybe it's a stylistic thing. Random splotches are in this season or something. The cylinder floats into my arms, and I grab it with both hands. It has less mass than I expected. It's probably hollow. It's a container. There's something inside they want me to see. I hold the cylinder under one arm and use the other to deal with tethers. I hurry back to the airlock. It's a stupid thing to do. There's no reason to hurry, and it literally endangers my life. One slip-up and I'd be off in space, but I just can't wait. I get back into the ship, cycle the airlock, and float into the control room with my prize in hand. I open the Orland suit, already thinking about what tests I'll run on the cylinder. I have a whole lab to work with. The smell hits me immediately. I gasp and cough. The cylinder is bad. No, not bad, but it smells bad. I can barely breathe. The chemical smell is familiar. What is it? Cat pee. Ammonia. It's ammonia. Okay, I wheeze. Okay, think. My gut instinct is to close the suit again, but that would just trap me in a small volume with the ammonia that's already in here. Better to let the cylinder air out in the larger volume of the ship. Ammonia isn't toxic, at least not in small quantities, and the fact that I can still breathe at all tells me it's a small quantity. If it weren't, my lungs would have caustic burns and I'd be unconscious or dead by now. As it is, there's just a bad smell. I can handle a bad smell. I climb out the back of the suit while the cylinder floats in the middle of the console room. Now that it's not a shock anymore, I can handle the ammonia. It's no worse than using a bunch of Windex in a small room. Unpleasant, but not dangerous. I grab the cylinder, and it's hot as heck. I yelp and pull my hands away. I blow on them for a moment and check for burns. It wasn't too bad, not stovetop hot, but hot. Grabbing it with my bare hands was stupid. Flawed logic. I assumed that since I'd been holding it earlier, it was okay to do now. But earlier, I had very thick spacesuit gloves protecting my hands. You've been a bad alien cylinder, I say to it. You need a timeout. I pull my arm into my sleeve and wrap my hand in the cuff. I use my now protected knuckles to nudge the cylinder into the airlock. Once it's in, I close the door. I'll let it be for now. It'll cool down to ambient air temperature eventually. And while it does, I don't want it floating randomly around my ship. I don't think there's anything in the airlock that can get hurt by some heat. How hot was it? Well, I had both hands on it, like an idiot, for a fraction of a second. My own reaction time was enough to keep me from getting burned. So it's probably less than 100 degrees Celsius. I open and close my hands a few times. They don't hurt anymore, but the memory of the pain lingers. Where'd the heat come from? I mumbled. The cylinder was out in space for a good 40 minutes. Over that time, it should have radiated heat via black body radiation. It should be cold, not hot. I'm about 1 AU from Tau Ceti, and Tau Ceti has half the luminosity of the sun. So I don't think the tall light would have heated the cylinder up much. Definitely not more than black body radiation would cool it down. So either it has a heater inside, or it was extremely hot when it started its trip. I guess I'll find out soon enough. It's not very heavy, so it's probably thin. If there's no internal heat source, it'll cool off very fast in the air here. The room still smells like ammonia. Yuck. I float down to the lab. I don't know where to begin. So many things I want to do. Maybe I should start by just identifying the material the cylinder is made of. Something harmless to the Blip Bay's crew might be incredibly toxic to me, and neither of us would know it. Maybe I should check for radiation. I drift down to the lab table and put out a hand to steady myself. I'm getting better at zero-G thing. I think I remember seeing an astronaut documentary saying some people handle it fine, while others really struggle. Looks like I'm one of the lucky ones. I'm using lucky loosely here. I'm on a suicide mission, so, yeah. The lab is a mystery. It has been for a while. It's clearly set up with the idea that there'll be gravity. It has tables, chairs, test tube trays, etc. There's none of the usual stuff you would expect to see in a weightless environment. No Velcro on the walls, no computer screens at all angles, no efficient use of space, everything assumes there will be a floor. The ship can accelerate just fine, for a good long time, too. It had me at 1.5 Gs for probably a few years, but they can't expect me to just leave the engines on and fly in circles to keep gravity in the lab, right? I look around at each piece of lab equipment and try to relax my mind. There has to be a reason for this, and it's in my memory somewhere. The trick is to think about what I want to know, but not stress about it too much. It's like falling asleep. You can't really do it if you concentrate on it too hard. So many top-of-the-line pieces of equipment. I let my mind wander as I scan them all. The ship is a centrifuge. I remember it all now. That's why there's a mysterious area called cable fairing. That's where the spools and Xylon cables are. The ship can break in half, turn the crew compartment around, and spin. That turning around part, that's the weird thing I saw on the hull during my EVA. I remember the design now. It has two big hinges on it, allowing the crew compartment to turn around before the centrifuge is activated. It's strangely reminiscent of Apollo spacecraft. The lunar lander was attached below the command module at launch, but they'd separate, turn the command module around, and reconnect with the lander during their trip to the moon. It's one of those things that looks ridiculous, but ends up being the most effective way to solve a problem. I float back up to the cockpit and flip through screens on various consoles. As each one fails to be what I want, I move to the next. Finally, I find it. The centrifuge screen. It was hiding out as a subpanel in the life support screen. It looks simple enough. There are yaw, pitch, and roll readouts showing the current state of the ship, just like the navigation panel has. A separate readout is labeled crew compartment angle. That must be the turning around bit. Each one reads 0 degree per second. Below those is a button labeled engage centrifuge sequence. Underneath that are a bunch of numbers related to rotational acceleration rate, final speed, spooling rate, estimated G-force at the floor of the lab, 4 different screens for spool status. I guess there are 4 spools, 2 on each side, which emergency protocols to follow if there's a problem, and a lot more stuff I won't pretend to understand. The important thing is all those readouts have values already in them. Gotta love computers. They do all the thinking for you, so you don't have to. I do take a closer look at the emergency protocol mode. It just reads, spin down. I tap the readout and a drop-down appears. Looks like my options are spin down, halt all spools, and one in red labeled separate. I'm pretty sure I don't want to do that. I suspect spin down will slowly decelerate the ship's spin if there's a problem. Sounds good. So I'll leave it to set to that. I'm about to engage the centrifuge, but then I pause. Is everything tied down? Is it safe to suddenly have a bunch of force acting on the ship? I shake it off. The ship was accelerating constantly for several years. It has to be comfortable with the little centrifuge action, right? Right? As hundreds of astronauts have done before, I place my faith and my life in the hands of the engineers who designed the system. Dr. Loken, I guess. Hope she did her job. I push the button. First, nothing happens. I wonder if I even pressed it right, or if I just fumbled at the screen like I have so many times on my phone in the past. But then the alert chimes throughout the ship. The piercing triple beep repeats every few seconds. There is no way for any crew member to miss a signal like that. A final warning, I guess, in case the crew had a failure to communicate. Over my head, the Petrovascope screen changes to lockout mode. That confirms my earlier suspicion that the ship's maneuvering engines are astrophage-based. I mean, it's kind of obvious when you think about it, but I wasn't sure until now. The beeping stops and nothing really happens. Then I notice that I'm closer to the nav panel than I was before. I drifted to the edge of the room. I put my arm out to steady myself and get back to normal, and then I drift toward the nav panel again. "Oh," I say. "It's begun. I'm not drifting toward the nav panel. The whole cockpit is drifting toward me. The ship is starting to spin. Everything veers off and changes direction. That'll be because as the ship spins, the crew compartment is also turning around. This could get complicated." Right. I kick off the wall and into the pilot seat. I tilt, or rather the room tilts. No, that doesn't make sense. Nothing tilts. The ship is spinning around faster and faster. It's also accelerating the acceleration. Also, the front half of the ship has detached from the rear, and it's rotating around those two big hinges. When it's done, the nose will be pointed in toward the rear half of the ship. All of this is going on at the same time, so the forces I'm feeling are really weird. Extremely complicated stuff, but also not my problem. It's up to the computer to deal with. I watch the centrifuge panel. The pitch rate reads 0.17 degrees per second. Another readout labeled component separation reads 2.4 meters. There's a little beep, and the crew compartment angle readout blinks. It shows as 180 degrees. I assume this whole sequence was worked out well in advance to minimize shock to the system and or crew. I feel a slight pressure on my butt as the seat pushes up against me. The transition is very smooth. I just experience more and more gravity in what feels like a tilting room. It's a weird sensation. I know logically that I'm in a ship spinning around, but there are no windows to see out of, only screens. I check the telescope screen. That's still pointed at the blip A. The stars in the background do not move. It's accounting for my rotation somehow and canceling it. That bit of software was probably tricky, considering the camera probably isn't at the exact center of rotation. My arms grow heavy, so I put them on the armrests. I have to start using my neck muscles again for the first time in a while. 5 minutes after the sequence begin, I experience a little less than normal Earth gravity. A quadruple beep announces the end of the sequence. I check the centrifuge screen. It shows a pitch rate of 20.71 degrees per second, a total separation of 104 meters, lab gravity of 1. The diagram of the ship shows the Hail Mary split in two pieces, the nose of the crew compartment pointed inward toward the other half. The two halves are comically far apart, and the entire system spins slowly. Well, actually, pretty fast, but it looks slow at that scale. I unstrap from the chair, walk to the airlock, open the hatch. The smell of ammonia drifts into the cockpit again, but not nearly as bad as before. The alien artifact lies on the floor. I give it a quick touch with my finger to gauge temperature. It's still pretty warm, but no longer scalding hot. Good. There's no internal heater or weird stuff like that. It just started out really hot. I pick it up. Time to see what this thing is made of and what's inside. Before leaving the cockpit, I take one last look at the telescope screen. I don't know why. I guess I just like to keep track of what extraterrestrial ships in my vicinity are up to. The blip A spins in space. It rotates end over end, probably at the exact same rate as the Hail Mary. I guess they saw me spin up the centrifuge and figured it was another communication thing. Humanity's first miscommunication with an intelligent alien race. Glad I could be a part of it. I set the cylinder on the lab table. Where do I begin? Everywhere. I check to see if it's radioactive with a Geiger counter. It's not. That's nice. I poke it with various things to get a feel for its hardness. It's hard. It looks like metal, but doesn't quite feel like metal. I use a multimeter to see if it's conductive. It isn't. Interesting. I get a hammer and chisel. I want a small chip of the cylinder material for the gas chromatograph. That way, I'll know what elements it's made of. After a few smacks with the hammer, the chisel chips. The cylinder isn't even dented. The cylinder is too big to put in the gas chromatograph, but I find a handheld X-ray spectrometer. It looks like a UPC scanner gun. Easy enough to use, and it'll give me some idea of what this thing is made of. It's not as accurate as the chromatograph, but better than nothing. After a quick scan, it tells me the cylinder is made of xenon. What? I use the spectrometer on the steel lab table to make sure it's working correctly. It reports iron, nickel, chromium, and so on. Just what it should say. So I check the cylinder again and get the same wacky results as with my first test. I test it 4 more times, but keep getting the same answer. Why did I run the test so many times? Because those results make no sense at all. Xenon is a noble gas. It doesn't react with anything. It doesn't form bonds with anything. And it's a gas at room temperature. But somehow it's part of the solid material. And no, it's not a cylinder filled with xenon or anything like that. A spectrometer is not a deep penetrating scan. It can only tell you what's on the surface. If I pointed it out at gold-plated nickel, it would say 100% gold, because that's all it can see. It can only tell me what the molecules on the surface of the cylinder are made of. Apparently, they're made of xenon. This handheld spectrometer can't detect elements lower than aluminum. So there could be carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, whatever is lurking in there too. But as for elements within the detector's range, I'm looking at pure xenon. How? I plop down on a stool and stare at the cylinder. What a strange artifact. What do I even call noble gases that react with things? Ignomals? But being flummoxed has one good side effect. It makes me stop my frenzied attack on the cylinder and just look at it. For the first time, I see that there is a thin line running around the circumference about an inch from the top. I feel it with my fingernail. It's definitely an indentation of some kind. Is that a lid? Maybe it just opens. I pick up the cylinder and try to pull off the top. It doesn't budge. On a whim, I try to unscrew it. It also doesn't budge. But there's no reason aliens would follow the righty-tighty, lefty-loosey rule, is there? I turn the lid to the right, and it rotates. My heart skips a beat. I keep turning. After 90 degrees, I feel it release. I pull the two chunks apart. Both halves have complicated stuff going on inside. They look like models of some kind. They both feature whisker-thin poles sticking up from their bases, leading to spheres of various sizes. I don't see any moving parts, and everything appears to be made out of the same weird material as the case. I check out the bottom half. Have to start somewhere. A single whisker holds up an abstract sculpture. It's a marble-sized sphere and a BB-sized sphere, each held in place by thinner whiskers branching off the main vertical trunk. There's also an oddly parabolic shape connecting the tops of the two spheres. This whole thing looks familiar to me. Why? Petrovoline, I blurt out. I've seen that arc shape enough times to know it by heart. My heart races. I point to the large sphere. So you must be a star, and the little guy must be a planet.